Well, there's a little bit of hardware missing from the studio this morning. We're trying to track it down. We picked up some awards last night at the Michigan Association of Broadcasters gathering, annual awards event in downtown Lansing at the Lansing Center. I'm proud to report here. So all we need is the actual hardware in the studio here to make it complete. But if we could blow our own horn for just a second here, current state winning a best in its division for community service for our Neighbors in Action segment. We won merit awards for music programming. And I remember that involves Melissa Benmark's interviews with Tim Muffet, and also an award for sound and use of medium for current state, as it turns out. We're also especially proud of our TV brethren, brothers and sisters. Don't know what the female equivalent of brethren is. WKAR-TV, top public TV station in its division. Way to go, Susie Elkins, Gary Reed, Tim Zico, and everybody in television. It's current state here on 90.5 WKAR. We're glad you could join us. It's hard to believe with the new snow and the single-digit temperatures, but we are 3 weeks away from the Crosstown Showdown home baseball opener between the Lansing Lugnuts and the MSU Spartans. Now, yesterday, Lugnuts owner Tom Dixon and city leaders announced plans for a $22 million development at Cooley Law School Stadium. And here to tell us more, current state's Kevin Lavery. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, Mark. How are you?
Real good.
Yes, this project will add a mix of residential and retail units near the stadium's outfield and some major upgrades within the stadium itself. Now, this needs approval, of course, from the city council. But after that, the city of Lansing will pay half the cost, that's $11 million, through a bond issue. I sat down yesterday with Michigan State University economist Eric Scorsone, a friend of this program. He's a member of the team that's monitoring the city's finances, and he thinks the project is a good step towards strong fiscal health.
So why did you decide to participate in Poetry Out Loud?
Well, Poetry Out Loud, I just thought would be...
Okay, we're obviously having a little bit of trouble bringing up our recorded segment involving the Lugnuts and the and developers here at Cooley Law School Stadium. Maybe Kevin, you could just help us just briefly understand just the basic gist of this, a $22 million project, and I guess the end game, so to speak, is ultimately apartments and a combination of options that are actually a part of the stadium.
Mix of, as I said, retail and residential, about 100 residential units, and this would be built right into essentially the outfield. Rates, of course, would vary depending upon the view, whether it's looking into the outfield or otherwise. Shatterproof glass, that's a question I raised with Pat Gillespie, the developer. You know, what if there's a home run that comes right to your living room? And literally, it's a personalized message from the Lugnuts.
About that.
Every now and then, you're going to hear a thump against your window, but that's all part of the experience. And these are things that people understand when they sign the lease. There's going to be a street-level bar and restaurant as well. And so several amenities that are involved here in this new project. I am told, Mark, that this is a unique project, certainly in minor league baseball franchises across the country. There are some 160 minor league teams in the United States, and I am told that really nothing like this has been accomplished before, where there's this structure, $22 million worth of construction, built right into the ballpark. And so it's really meant to be a placemaking type project, type venture that provides inexpensive family fun as it's being built.
It's certainly an attention getter. Assuming that we're unable to hear your exchange with Eric Scorsone, which appears likely here this morning, I'm wondering, Kevin, if you could even briefly touch on some of the questions that you asked Eric Scorsone with regard to the feasibility of this project. And I think you focused on really on the city's ability to finance its end of the project.
Right. And Again, that's $11 million worth of bonds, which would be issued over about 15 years. If you remember back almost exactly a year ago when the financial health team issued its report for the city of Lansing, there were many different recommendations and suggestions, one of which just touched briefly upon Cooley Law School Stadium. The city's general fund has about $500,000 of that money that goes from the general fund that goes to directly subsidize the stadium.
Okay. I am told that we've got the exchange with Eric Scorsone ready to go. Let's take a listen to Eric Scorsone of Michigan State University and current state's Kevin Lavery.
We did address the issue that the city was having to subsidize the stadium among other investments that they had made. So I think this is a move in the right direction. Obviously, with any investment, there is some risk involved, but I think it seems like a manageable risk. And I think if this is a way to improve the stadium, which is an important asset, and avoid the city having to subsidize improvements, then that is a positive step in the right direction.
So this is in line with your team's recommendations. This doesn't seem like an unnecessarily risky proposition then on the city's part.
No, I don't think so, especially given it's established team and established stadium. It might be different if it was a new kind of investment of that nature, but I think given that it's, you know, a team that has a record and I think this is the movement towards downtown living. So I think it is in line with national trends, and I think that's a smart move, and I think it will again reduce some of that financial pressure on the general fund of the city.
Have we seen examples in the past, Eric, of similarly sized or even larger cities that have added on to their downtown sports complexes in some way such as this, and the type of benefits economically it's reaped for them? Or is this sometimes a thing that goes the other direction where it's not the return on investment that they planned?
Yeah, I mean, I'll be honestly, you can definitely find examples of both. I would say my own personal experience from Denver is that, you know, Coors Field was a huge boon to downtown Denver, as was the redevelopment of Mile High Stadium. There are examples of these that have gone bad as well. But again, I think given that this is an established stadium you're building onto, it's a little less risky than a completely new investment. And I do think that, you know, this is a movement where people do want to start living in a downtown environment. So I think it's a smart investment. There's always going to be risk, of course, because if people don't live there and they don't get the rents, then obviously there would be some pressure. But I think it's a reasonable risk to take in this environment.
Naturally, every city wants density in its downtown core, and Lansing has worked very hard to achieve that with this project, with the Accident Fund headquarters, the former Ottawa Street Power Station, the newly designed city market. There's some riverfront developments along the way, the stadium district, lots of activity downtown. But are we really seeing that density return to the core in a way that will keep the city viable in terms of revenue and tax structure?
Well, they're really two separate issues. I mean, the downtown development is needed, and that's an important part of the tax base of the city. I think as far as the city's overall financial challenges, it's going to help, but these are huge challenges, the legacy cost issues. I don't think they're going to be completely addressed by downtown development. So the city needs to do downtown development, absolutely, but we have to recognize this probably isn't going to address all of the healthcare and pension challenges the city has. And I think this is a good move to look at residential, because we do know that it's not enough to have employment downtown. You've got to have the residential piece. So I think that's an important piece. But I don't think this is nearly not going to be enough to address all the financial challenges the city has.
Lansing has a AA bond rating, one of the strongest of any city its size in the Midwest. What has kept Lansing more viable than many similarly sized cities in the country who have tried to do many different development projects like this?
Well, I think historically the city's had, you know, because of the state government, has had a more stable employment base, and that's helped. It hasn't lost the population. I think we haven't had the urban blight of a Flint or a Saginaw, or cities of that nature. So I think, you know, and that's because the city's economy has been more diverse historically, not just GM. It's had other you know, employers. And that's good. And I think, you know, having the university has been a positive for the region as a whole. So I think they can build on those assets, you know, and that's a difference from some of the other cities in Michigan But again, I would emphasize, we still have some really serious financial challenges. I think things are moving in the right direction, absolutely, compared to 3 or 4 years ago, of course. But the city still faces some real challenges going forward, like a lot of cities. And bond ratings are, that's one aspect of looking at cities' finances. It's not the whole story necessarily.
You and I had met earlier this year to review what has happened in the year since the financial health team issued its report. What have been some significant milestones since, let's say, the beginning of the year that Lansing has made some good progress toward?
Well, I think the city's looking at some improvements in, so for example, information technology systems, which is critical for any business this day and age. I think the city budget had, you know, addressed some of the financial health team recommendations. I think more of that's going to be done in the future. And so I do feel positive that, you know, the mayor has taken some very good steps forward. I think the mayor and the council need to be credited with doing some progressive leadership where, you know, other cities honestly haven't been able to do that. But there's a lot of hard work. They need to dig in and keep going. You know, that's the key, is to keep the momentum now. So, you know, the fiscal sustainability training that we're doing with city council right now, I think, is another great mark of a city that's looking forward and saying, how do we address our long-term problems? So these are the kind of things we would want to see for the kind of city Lansing is.
How is that training with the council going? That's a pretty unique project, I think.
It is. It's very different. Most of these kind of trainings are kind of the minimal, what's the law say? We're really going beyond that, saying what's the best practice, not what does the law say. And I think it's going very well. I think the council's really had some great questions. I think we've had some good interaction. And so we'll be doing another one on Monday the 17th and Monday the 31st. And so this is really unique in the state, and we hope to model this for other cities, of course, in the future. So I think it's been a great start, and I appreciate their willingness to engage in this training.
Mayor Brunero will present his budget proposal very soon. Watching that and going forward with these recommendations, I'm just wondering if the financial health team is still going to be a cohesive unit going forward, or is the task largely done at this point?
No, I think what you'll hear in the future is some announcements regarding that. I think we need to keep the momentum of this kind of effort going because it's a long-term effort. We don't expect the fixes to occur overnight. So I feel very positive that there'll be news coming out regarding a continued effort to review the city's finances and those kinds of activities.
Eric Scorsone is an economist at Michigan State University. Eric, thank you.
Thank you.
For Current State, I'm Kevin Lavery.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR. A hotly debated change involving abortion insurance in Michigan takes effect today. The new Abortion Insurance Opt-Out Act bans insurance companies from offering coverage for the procedure as a standard part of a policy. Persons wanting the coverage will need to purchase a separate rider for their policy. Supporters of the law say people who oppose abortion should have the right not to have their premiums underwrite the procedure. A majority of the GOP-led Michigan legislature agreed with that position last December and passed it along party lines. Now, opponents blast the measure for several reasons, but mainly because it will effectively limit access to abortion. No private insurance company currently has plans to offer the abortion riders. For now, that limits coverage to a handful of employer-sponsored health plans. Here to help us understand this change is David Waymeyer. Dave joins us as a spokesman for the Michigan Association of Health Plans. Hi, David.
Hello. How are you this morning?
Just fine. At the top, give us an idea what health plans are members of this association, the Michigan Association of Health Plans.
Virtually every health plan in the state that is not Blue Cross Blue Shield of Michigan is a member of the MAHP. So that would be HAP, the Health Alliance plan people, Priority Health, large companies like that that have stepped in and are providing lots of competition and opportunities for people to purchase health insurance around the state.
Has your association adopted a position on this new law?
No, the association stays out of the abortion issue and has chosen not to get involved in it historically or in this one. We're just trying to provide some factual information to people like you who are interested in learning more about it.
Well, what is the situation right now, if you can maybe go a little bit deeper with us? Who is offering this coverage? Who will be offering these riders, and who can get it and who can't?
Well, interestingly enough, it appears from our conversations with companies that most of the companies that are part of the Michigan Association Health Plan family were already offering this service as a rider only. So there's really no change for most of the customers that will be working with the Michigan Association Health Plans. It is my understanding, however, that Blue Cross did include more generalized voluntary abortion coverage in many of their plans. So if you are a Blue Cross customer, there may be somewhat of a change. But the interesting piece that is coming out of this is the cost of the policies that are out there are this rider will be extremely, extremely small. I mean, I'm hearing from anywhere from just a penny a month to 30 cents a month, which is, you know, relatively small amounts. And so if women are interested in having this coverage, or men, or fathers, or husbands, if we're women in their families, it should be pretty easy for them to approach their employers and say, hey, we'd like you to offer this. And I know that in our company, if we get approached, we certainly will consider it.
But if Blue Cross you did say Blue Cross Blue Shield is offering the riders as well.
That's my understanding, yes.
Okay. So
previously, Blue Cross had, as my understanding, had included it kind of as part of the package because it's, like I said, relatively small cost.
I'm also wondering here, David, if insurance companies realize there may be some unsatisfied demand for these riders, couldn't we see more of them begin to offer it? And are any members of the MHHP discussing that?
You know, I think the companies have made their decisions in the past based on what they see as need and the value of the product. I mean, again, the cost of it indicates that it's a relatively low-cost procedure and that there really are not that many abortions that are covered by insurance or haven't been covered by insurance in Michigan earlier. I know Dave Eggert from the Associated Press pointed out that
it's just over 3%. Yeah.
739. So it's really rather interesting, Mark. This is sort of a tempest in a teapot in some ways in terms of its real impact. And one of the things that I walked away from this with personally was, gee, it would have been really nice for the legislature to hold one single hearing on this issue. There was never even one hearing held by the Senate or the House so that some of these facts could have come out, some of these prices could have come out, and perhaps we would have had a more factual discussion of this rather than a lot of the emotional heat that really didn't provide too much light on the subject.
It might also be worth pointing out that federal law requires that Medicaid cover abortion in the case of rape or incest, correct?
Yeah, so you have a situation where low-income women who are on Medicaid actually have an additional benefit that maybe some other women who are buying insurance in a private market will not. The other piece that's pretty important for people to realize is that those are companies are offering this through their general plans, but not through the exchange. If you're buying individual coverage or family coverage on the exchange, it's the federal law already made it very difficult, virtually impossible, for companies to offer coverage for abortions. People who are buying through the exchange will not have that coverage.
But just how much, in your view, does this new law change things?
Really, not that much. I mean, that the ban on the federal abortions through the exchange was passed through the federal government. So this really doesn't change very much at all in a lot of ways. What it may, in fact, do, however, is make women who were unaware that their employer didn't have a rider, or whether they did have a rider, they may be able to go to their employer, ask for coverage, and those employers may be able to step up and provide that coverage. So at the end, you may end up having more women covered through the rider than they were before.
Hmm. Well, we want to thank David Waymire, who is a spokesman for the Michigan Association of Health Plans. We've been talking about Michigan's new Abortion Insurance Opt-Out Act, which takes effect today. Thanks, David.
My pleasure.
Garden State on 90.5 WKAR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mark Bayshore. While some people tend to disregard the paranormal as just shadows and creaky floorboards, others decide to dive further into the unknown. Our next guest decided to do just that. Samantha Harris is a spiritual healer, demonologist, paranormal investigator, and founder of the Michigan Paranormal Research Association. Samantha works on shows about the paranormal for the Travel Channel and the Destination America Channel, among others. And the MSU graduate recently became a published author. Fighting Malevolent Spirits, A Demonologist's Darkest Encounters, include several cases here in Michigan, including Lansing, that might just make the hair on your neck stand up. She joins us today to talk more about her experiences. Samantha, welcome to Current State.
Oh, thank you. Good morning. It's a pleasure to be back in my old stomping grounds here at the Communications Building.
You're a Comm Arts grad?
Right, right. Okay. Yeah, I miss the MSU campus. So I work now down, unfortunately, at U of M. So, so it's nice to kind of reconnect. Yeah.
So, okay, you learned they offer paranormal communication here in the Comm Arts department. I didn't know that.
Exactly. That's what I specialized in. No, just basically my background's in communications with a little bit of abnormal psychology, and that kind of helps give me a good perspective and a background when I'm working on these cases with families, so it's quite interesting.
So you are a paranormal investigator and the founder of the Michigan Paranormal Research Association. What kinds of situations do you study and investigate?
Exactly? Well, originally I started out with just basic hauntings, and I know it's a little bit of a stretch to ask people to believe in the paranormal, even though like 3/4 of Americans actually do, but then I'm kind of taking a step further talking about different types of hauntings, specifically inhuman hauntings, which are typically more severe in nature. So a lot of the families I deal with, they have severe dysfunctional kind of elements going on with their family, such as, you know, alcoholism, substance abuse, sexual violence, depression, chronic illness, things like that. And it's kind of an interesting case and psychological perspective. For me, it's kind of like who came first, the chicken or the egg? Is it this haunting caused by these bad habits in these families? Or, you know, was this entity or this inhuman spirit actually attracted to them? But it kind of goes hand in hand in every case that I deal with that's this severe.
What is an inhuman haunting? There's a human haunting and an inhuman haunting?
Yeah, well, it kind of goes back into like different theology perspectives, but basically, you know, demonology is the study of these inhuman entities that are believed to be, you know, kind of going across an Abrahamic belief that they are kind of like fallen angels, I guess you could say, which to me it even sounds outlandish and kind of ridiculous, but the things that I've seen and experienced with these families in these cases, I really can't explain for our scientific means as of right now.
Well, let's look at one of these things. I mean, and this is one, these are all collected in your book, I take it. The book is a collection of these experiences.
Yep, exactly. Yeah, and I kind of wanted to set it up as a self-help book, but with the publishers, they kind of wanted to reorganize it as, you know, a collection of my most severe cases that I really couldn't explain and really share, you know, the traumatic experience that these families went through. And then I also provide in the appendix kind of how-to instructions for people to remove these hauntings, because a lot of the people that contact me, they've asked their church for help, they've had botched, you know, home exorcisms basically, and they're kind of left without, you know, any sort of solution. So I wanted to teach people, and I believe very firmly that they themselves can do this. You know, I'm not special whatsoever. You know, I teach people how to do their own house blessings, and it works even if you're not having a haunting, just to remove any built up negative energy per se. And I know that sounds goofy to say that, but, you know, say there's somebody with cancer or, you know, chronic depression, they've actually proven that when you perform house blessings, say, for example, you know, burning white sage or something like that, it actually alters the environment, specifically the ions. So there's actually, we're starting to prove there is scientific evidence behind these house blessings that something's actually changing and improving the environment. To me, that's fascinating.
Is a house blessing kind of the updated way to describe what used to be called an exorcism? Is that
right,
the flip side of an exorcism?
Right, or? And I think it sounds a little bit more palatable that way too, but, you know, commonly it's believed exorcism or when you exorcise a spirit from a human's body, but that can apply to a home, an object, a place, you know, land. It's believed that energy is kind of imprinted on the ground. So when you kind of cleanse that per se, it makes a big difference in these families' lives.
We're talking with Samantha Harris, who is the author of Fighting Malevolent Spirits, A Demonologist's Darkest Encounter. That word scares the hell out of me. I have a hard time saying demonologist.
Spooky.
What is the most, can you share one or two or the more memorable experiences you've had then?
Yeah, one of the cases that was actually included in the book was also featured on Discovery Channel's sister network, which was Destination America, and it was on the show A Haunting, and basically it's like a reenactment of it, but the case there was a 19-year-old guy who was about, oh, I would say like 320 pounds, 6'2", like a bigger guy, you know, not easy to throw around, but he was actually thrown across the room by an unseen force. There's multiple witnesses. Right before the blessing, all the kitchen cabinets opened up, and, you know, it wasn't animals or anything like that. It wasn't because, you know, the cabinets weren't balanced correctly. You know, I've seen people be scratched or burned by things that you can't see and measure, which is, to me, fascinating. And that's kind of why I like this. It's like the last frontier, in my opinion, of like the scientific community. And we just haven't, you know, found the exact specific ways to document and measure these events. But we have a little bit of background in that. I've seen other cases where, you know, we had a woman down in Grosse Pointe, Michigan, where she believed she had a poltergeist, which is, German for like noisy spirit or an active spirit. And she was actually thrown on her floor, her marble hallway, and it knocked out her front teeth. They had water materialize out of thin air, banging and weird sounds throughout the house. And she hired in all these different labor workers, like a plumber, electrician, just to kind of debunk the whole thing. And they themselves were even like, you might have something here. You might have a poltergeist. So it's definitely interesting.
What's the most dramatic incident that you yourself have witnessed?
I would definitely say the 19-year-old being thrown across the room, and his friend was punched in the stomach as well.
You saw that?
Yeah. And it was really interesting to see some of these things happening in the house. And, you know, you read about these things, you hear about these stories, but when you're actually there present in the home and these things start happening, I mean, how do you explain that? I mean, are we all hallucinating? You know, it's really kind of compelling to me to really research this further. And there's dangers with this line of work. You know, it's impacted my personal life greatly, and it kind of changes, the way you sleep. You know, I've had what I believe to be entities visiting me in my house prior to a house blessing. And I think it's an effort to kind of intimidate me or scare me away from helping people. And a lot of people don't want to help these families because it is intense. It is definitely a risk.
Did you have to do anything in particular to provoke this throwing incident that you referred to? I mean, do you have to go in there? Was it your aim to witness something like that?
No, and of course I want to help kind of prove in the scientific community that these things are real, but I'm a big advocate for not provoking. I think it's something, this line of work should be respected. It shouldn't be aggravated whatsoever. And so I really go in there and counsel with these families for several hours and then perform a house blessing. And oftentimes there'll be a lot of activity right before a house blessing because, you know, it's kind of like a cornered animal that you're dealing with, and they're going to put up every last effort to try to prevent you from performing your job. I don't believe in provoking. I try to just focus strictly on the family and the trials and tribulations that they're going through before dealing with the house blessing.
What's been the reception from the families that you write about in your book? Were they happy to hear that you were writing about them? I mean,
Yeah. A lot of the families really wanted their story to be told, but they're kind of afraid, if they were to publicly speak about this. You know, we kind of ostracize people for, being insane or crazy, and it's more common than what people believe. It's just that we kind of stigmatize these different events as, something that maybe it's a mental illness. And I actually go through a psychological evaluation with every family to make sure that there's not other elements in play, to kind of debunk the paranormal encounters. But, a lot of the families are really delighted and happy to have their stories shared. Obviously, for privacy protection reasons, I changed their name, but everything in the book is accurate and true. And, I decided to keep some of the graphic details and some of the disturbing parts about these cases because it's realistic, it's true. It kind of gives you a psychological background on what's going on with these families.
How did you learn how to do a house blessing? What were these were being done in some form before you got involved in this? And have you altered how you do these things?
Right. I'm definitely unorthodox, and I actually kind of created my own method. And I've taught like hundreds of people online how to perform their own. You know, I have YouTube videos. I have instructions online for free, but it's also included in my book, too, is that I basically studied many different cultures and religions, and I actually took away from everyone, like, what is the most potent method that they practice to remove, you know, negative energy, what they believe to be evil spirits. And I actually kind of put them together and made this kind of little crazy method. But, you know, I use Christian, Catholic, Native American, and South American methods. And to me, they've been very successful. You know, out of the 80-some-odd house blessings that I performed, only two of them were unsuccessful. And, you know, I have a couple theories on that. And one of which, you know, not everyone in the family was on board for it. You know, the other, one of the sons, like, didn't care that his mom was being physically assaulted and attacked by something. He didn't really care. And then the other case was that not everyone was present in the home, and we didn't get to counsel with everyone. And so they were gone for part of the house blessing and then returned later. So now I kind of revamped my method that everyone has to be present. Everyone wants this to be removed. And I use a non-denominational approach because I don't want to, you know, infringe upon anyone's beliefs and stuff. I'm very, I accept everyone's religious views and beliefs. So I kind of structure each house blessing and counseling and cleansing session around their views as well, which to me is interesting because that would point to me in my mind that, you know, whatever greater power exists is kind of beyond our man-made concepts. So I think it's very interesting.
And how do you respond briefly to really hardened skeptics?
Right.
Walk up to you and say, Samantha, this is just all a load of hooey.
Right,
I mean,
yep,
how do you respond?
I mean, I think it sounds crazy too. You know, I know that. And I actually, this is off topic, I have a learning disability called dyscalculia, and I actually had a psychological DSM-4 psych evaluation. So I'm actually sane, so that's good. But I appreciate skeptics. We need skeptics in the world. Everything should be questioned. And that's actually the perspective that I myself started from. But if you don't go and research these things and actually investigate them, how are you going to experience it? It's a rare thing with demonic hauntings. But when you actually kind of dive into that line of work, you're bound to find something. And eventually you can't explain these things.
Samantha Harris is a spiritual healer, demonologist, paranormal investigator, and founder of the Michigan Paranormal Research Association. Her new book is called Fighting Malevolent Spirits, A Demonologist's Darkest Encounters. Thanks, Samantha. Good luck.
Thank you.
Current state on 90.5 WKAR. Follow us on Twitter at KAR Current State. Email us at currentstate@wkar.org. Michigan State University officials have announced a plan to help out the state's 43,000 prisoners. The university's College of Human Medicine will collaborate with the Michigan Department of Corrections in an effort to share the school's expertise and resources toward promoting prisoner health. Across the country, the prison population is aging. It also includes many who did not have access to basic health services prior to sentencing. Among other things, the collaboration will include creation of a health care model geared to the prison population with an emphasis on education and prevention. Here to tell us more is the Dean of MSU's College of Human Medicine, Dr. Marcia Rapley. Welcome to Current State.
Thank you. Good morning.
Are Michigan, is there a consensus, Dr. Rapley, that Michigan prisoners are underserved now with regard to their health and medical needs?
Well, generally, we think of prison populations across the nation as underserved in that, as you stated in your introduction, so many of them had difficulty with access to health care prior to sentencing. And then they will be in prison, some of them, for quite a long time. They will age in prison, and these problems will continue to exist. And if we don't get a handle on them with a preventive focus, they will get worse before we have an opportunity to intervene.
But is there a glaring deficiency in the services that are available to Michigan prisoners now?
No, I don't think we're about trying to fix a horrible problem. We're really working with the Michigan Department of Corrections to take a new vision for prison health care, a population-based approach looking at evidence-based medicine, bringing the best practices in medicine to the prison population. In Michigan, it's over 43,000 people, and they have diabetes, they have hypertension, they have all kinds of chronic conditions that could really benefit from an approach where we start from the beginning, from education, and we look at systematically how symptoms are evaluated and diagnoses are made, and then how treatments are implemented within the prison. I think the really important part of this is to be aware that 90% of our prisoners will be discharged back into the community, and so establishing a link for these folks to continue their health care once they return to the community has been extraordinarily difficult. And we hope to be looking at improving that continuity of care during prison and after prison.
Can you talk to us about the particular resources that the College of Human Medicine will bring to this project?
Well, we have some talented faculty whose work is really in preventive medicine and takes a very public health perspective towards the practice of medicine. And so it's that expertise we're bringing to collaborate with the Department of Corrections and helping them think through this vision for the prison population of population-based health management, and also then helping them in searching for physicians and educating their professional development for their staff around all of these concepts.
I know that a couple of particular features of this collaboration include the creation of a health and disease management approach to correctional health care. That sounds more proactive. What is involved in this management approach?
Well, you're absolutely right. The intent is to become proactive. So rather than waiting for people to develop symptoms of diabetes ad hoc, kind of, you know, one at a time, so to speak, there can be a surveillance about, well, there can be education first so that people understand their own health and what their symptoms mean, and then there can be surveillance for the kinds of things that suggest people might either be developing diabetes or having problems with their current diabetes, so that we get ahead of the ball here. We're not waiting until a person needs to be taken to the hospital to have the appropriate diagnosis and services for their condition. Rather, we're catching these things at the point in time where we can manage them much more effectively.
We're talking with Dr. Marcia Rapley, who is the Dean of the College of Human Medicine here at Michigan State University. We're talking about a new collaborative effort between the College of Human Medicine and the Department of Corrections in the state of Michigan to assist Michigan's prison population. What about the costs here, Dr. Rapley? Is this entirely taxpayer-funded, or does it require additional expenditures outside of the Department of Corrections budget or MSU's budget?
Well, this is done within our budgets. We all have to work within our budgets, from our households to our institutions. But really, the intent here is to reduce the cost. So we know that when we respond to medical emergencies that could have been prevented, when we're transporting a prisoner who is very sick with perhaps a very high blood sugar that could have been prevented, there's a tremendous cost in that for the prison population as well as for the health systems that provide care for these people. So if we are in this preventive mode, if we are looking to get ahead of the ball, as we talked about earlier, then perhaps we can be reducing the cost of health care and really redirecting those dollars to improving the health of our prison population rather than responding after the fact to their ill health.
In the press release announcing this collaboration, you suggested that assisting the prison population could have benefits for the whole state, for the public at large. How exactly?
Yes, I actually feel pretty strongly about that. We often imagine that we exist in these different sort of groups or populations or pockets of diversity, but there's a great deal that we have in common. And when we look at people who are currently in prison, understanding how they interacted with the healthcare system before they came to prison, what their needs are while they're in prison, and establishing the connections that will help them to remain healthy, to be employable, to make contributions back to society. That is going to help us understand the very complicated needs of people who are not in prison, because those lessons will be transferred to any group of people who've been somewhat disenfranchised or perhaps not had good access to health care for a long period of time.
Dr. Marcia Rapley is the dean of MSU's College of Human Medicine. We've been talking about a new initiative in collaboration with the Michigan Department of Corrections. Marcia, thank you very much. Good luck.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
High schoolers from across the state will convene in East Lansing on Friday for the annual Michigan Poetry Out Loud Championship. At the event, students will recite famous works from memory. Judith Dworkin of the Michigan Humanities Councils is the Poetry Out Loud officer for the state. She's with us now in the current state studios. Hi, Judith.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you here. And joining us by phone, Eric Hammerstorm, who teaches language arts and AP English at Marquette Senior High School. Many of Eric's students participate in the Poetry Out Loud program. Eric, thanks for joining us.
I'm glad to be here.
Judith, tell us about Poetry Out Loud then.
Sure, Mark. So Poetry Out Loud is a national poetry recitation competition for high school students. It's put on by the National Endowment for the Arts and is brought to Michigan by the Michigan Humanities Council and the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. We give out curriculum material to high school teachers all over the state, and in turn, the teachers implement poetry into their classrooms, and at the end they have a school competition to select a school champion to come to the state finals, which will happen tomorrow.
Is it largely does it focus on performance then, or what?
It focuses on performance, yes, but also the bringing the poem to life on stage. So it's the student's job to make sure that the poem is being recited in such a way that the audience feels the poem and understands the poem.
Eric Hammerstorm, tell us about how your students feel about participating in this, and give us your angle on this event.
Well, the kids really embrace it at different levels. Some of them find for the very first time a spot on the stage in the spotlight, where, you know, some of our students who haven't been varsity athletes or have not made it to center stage in terms of class president or other things, they get a chance to shine. And there's a state championship for people who recite poems. That's pretty exciting. And you know, a lot of those kids are left out in a lot of programs in schools. We have a student who, you know, for the first time, she's heading off to a state championship. It's going to be a fantastic experience for her. Not only that, today's an age of science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. The spoken word is often left out of all of that, and this brings it back and makes it important to kids.
How are your students' attitudes in general when you teach a poetry section, Eric? How are your students' attitudes in general? Are they there because they enjoy poetry already, or do you find that some of them actually resist opening themselves up to poetry?
I think students who have experience with music, it's much easier to connect with them. So students who have had the opportunity to study art and music as kids, it's easy to tie in because poetry really is music. It's, but your voice is your instrument. And we're fortunate in Marquette. We have a fantastic music program at our high school. Our choral program is great. We have an awesome jazz band and a great orchestra. And so for those kids, it's an easy transition. And then they just use their voice as the instrument of the poem. For other kids who haven't done that, it's a harder leap to make.
Judith, geographically, where do your participants come from?
So they come from all over the state, actually. We have schools as far away as Houghton, Eric and Marquette.
That's about as far away as you can get.
That's
yeah.
right. And
Michigan.
then a lot from Detroit, Grand Rapids, and mid-Michigan as well.
And Eric, there is such a strong emphasis on STEM. Do you ever find any of those STEM students in a poetry section that you teach?
Sometimes, you know, but it's hard to... When kids are thinking about school as a way to get a job with a big paycheck, it's really hard to sell poetry to them if that's the mindset.
Yeah.
I was a poetry major, and now off of my poetry, I've made $5, a pitcher of beer, and a free pizza. And so, but you can't put a dollar amount on finding the right words to say to someone at an important moment
sure.
in your life.
Sure.
And, but you also can't buy that. And, you know, it's an intangible. It's, but it's a very important thing that I think has been lost to a lot of people.
Oh,
and
it
that's
can
what
be,
I,
it can
I'm,
be.
I'm glad that Poetry Out Loud and the Michigan Humanities Council see the value in that. And I try to teach that value to kids. I think they'll get it. Maybe not for 10 years, but they'll get it later.
Interesting. Judith, what poems do students typically like to pick for this event?
So there's a whole range. The students can pick poems from a national anthology that is online with the National Endowments for the Arts. And there are hundreds and hundreds of poems. Ones that I've seen, it seems that Jabberwocky comes up every now and then. Also A March in the Rank of Hard Pressed comes up a lot as well. But there are really, really hundreds of them. Students tend to try to pick the more challenging ones because one of the criteria of the judges is to judge the level of complexity of the poem as well. So if they do choose more challenging poems, they get more points on their recitation.
How many years back does Poetry Out Loud go?
So in Michigan, this is our ninth year, and nationally, it's in its 10th year, I believe. But we've been doing it in Michigan for 9 years. We'll celebrate our 10-year anniversary next year.
What's the trajectory in terms of interest and participation? Has it gone up, or is it a challenge to reach out and connect with young people who want to participate?
Actually, the program has grown since we began the program in Michigan. In the beginning, we started off with maybe 10 high schools, and then as the program grew, we moved to 20, we moved to 30. The fall applications, we get over 50 schools applying to Poetry Out Loud, and then who implement the curriculum in their classrooms. And then we have at least up to 40 students who will come to the state champions. Each year, the students become more and more savvy, and so the competition becomes harder.
Eric, how vigorously do you talk up the Poetry Out Loud program in your classes?
Well, we do a little bit with it in all of my classes, and there are really 4 out of our 6 English teachers in Marquette are pretty into it. And so all of my kids do classroom-based activities. They don't all advance to our school championship, but the kids who are really good, they're begging to get into that competition level in front of the whole school in the full theater. It's great. We have, you know, every seat full, and, you know, cheers and people hollering and for poems being recited. This year, after two rounds of poems, we had a tie. It was like 287-287. And somehow, with four judges judging, two people tied. And so we had a showdown, a poetry recitation showdown.
Poetry smackdown.
Tiebreaker. It was like, it was amazing. It was like, you know, like the shootout at the Olympics in Sochi with the Americans and the Russians. It was like that with two people out there. And it's pretty cool to see that happening for a couple of poems.
I'm sure the kids must respond to that an awful lot. It sounds emotional. Judith, if people want to attend some of these performances, what do they do? Where do they go?
So the state finals, they're free and open to the public. It will be tomorrow at the East Lansing Hannah Community Center from 9 o'clock to 4 o'clock. We'll start with round one at 9 o'clock in the morning, round two at 12:30, and round three at 3 o'clock. We'll also have a poet performance by poetry duo Kinetic Effect out of Kalamazoo.
Judith Dworkin is the Poetry Out Loud Officer for the Michigan Humanities Councils, and Eric Hammerstorm teaches English at Marquette Senior High School. Judith and Eric, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
The state competition for Michigan's 2013-14 Poetry Out Loud program, again, will take place tomorrow at the East Lansing Hannah Community Center Auditorium. One of the students presenting tomorrow is Matthew Wiesner. Current state production assistant Kelsey Block spoke with Matthew, who's a freshman at East Lansing High School, about his upcoming performance.
So why did you decide to participate in Poetry Out Loud?
Well, Poetry Out Loud, I just thought, would be a great opportunity to be able to express myself, to perform in front of an audience, which is something that I enjoy doing. It's just, you know, help build confidence, that sort of thing, which has been really nice.
What poem have you selected and why?
We have to choose three poems for our performance. The first one I chose is a thank you note by Michael Ryan. It's a very emotional, heartfelt poem. It's about a man who received pens from one of his friends for his daughter, even though his friend's son had died from cancer. And I thought it was just an emotional poem, something, you know, that someone can relate to with the loss of a loved one. It was all very touching, and I thought it was very nice. The second poem is called A Life and a Love by Robert Browning. It's a poem about how there's a man who is at his wit's end about this girl that he loves because he keeps chasing her and trying to, you know, impress her. And this girl just kind of pays him no mind, is better than him, really, out of his league. And so this guy just doesn't know what to do. And so he's, you know, kind of going crazy. We've all had an experience like that we can relate to. And then my third poem is called Say Not the Struggle Not Availeth by Arthur Hugh Clough. It's a story about a general talking to his weary soldiers. They're getting slaughtered out there, pushed back. Everything is not going very well. And, you know, he's giving this inspirational speech that's saying, hey, even though we're doing bad, there's another day tomorrow. The sun is still rising. We can do this. We can keep out and hold out. And it's just a very inspirational poem. It reminds me of a famous Charlie Chaplin speech. And it's just really inspirational, which is what I love, performing in front of other people so I can inspire other people and in turn inspire myself.
Matthew Wiesner is a freshman at East Lansing High School. Matthew will perform with students from across the state Friday at the Michigan Poetry Out Loud competition, which is being held at the East Lansing Hannah Community Center. And that's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, we preview spring films with MLive's John Serba. Also, live music in Studio S from the Michigan Jazz Trail. That and more Friday here on Current State. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Worf. Joe Lindstroth is our producer. Thanks also to Emmanuel Berry, Melissa Benmark, Scott Pohl, and Kevin Lavery. Also to Aaron Young for engineering and Libby Losenhop for production assistance. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.